The meeting will please come to order. I'm Sandra Erickson. I chair the Policy Committee, and I will sit in this chair until the chairman, Pat Garofalo, arrives. He is at another important meeting. Today, we are hearing the Integration Revenue Replacement Advisory Task Force recommendations, and we don't want to keep all you folks waiting, so I think it's important that we get started. And we have two testifiers already seated, and would like them to... And would like them to introduce themselves, and if Mr. Thomas would go first, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Thomas. I was co-chair of the task force and currently work for the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan School District as the Integration and Educational Equity Coordinator.
Please go ahead, sir, with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chair. And members of the committee, it's a wonderful invitation to present the legislative recommendations. The task force you convened is certainly blue ribbon, if I may say so myself. A picture is located on the screen. And it was really a pleasure to work with these 11 other individuals, especially my co-chair, Peter Swanson. As you know, numerous task forces have undertaken this endeavor and have not had recommendations or recommendations that made it to legislation. Certainly, the time and effort put forth by this committee was significant. We met approximately 10, we had 10 meetings, spent over 30 hours in scheduled meetings, and in addition had numerous committee meetings in addition to the time that my co-chair and I spent. One of the most important groundings for this work was the legislative charge that you had set forth. And we referred to this charge on numerous occasions because we knew that it had to guide our work. So as we look at the legislative charge, certainly we knew that we had to look at, among other things, how districts may effectively narrow and close the academic achievement gap and foster academic success through the following: pursuing specific academic achievement goals, premised on continuous adapting of best teaching practices and efficient use of resources, identifying variables to show annual progress toward achieving student, school, and district goals for student academic success. The funding allocation for the new program should ensure funding stability for districts between the current integration program and the new program. Money shall be used for the purposes of purposes recommended and forwarded by the task force and approved and appropriated by the legislature. The other piece we leaned on was the task force members should seek input from organizations and individuals whose expertise can help inform the work of the task force and must develop recommendations to improve the academic achievement of students. We took this task to heart. The 12 members of this task force came committed, ready, and stayed engaged. Some may say that our task force was designed to fail. Many thought that we could never succeed, but we did. We came to consensus around one of the most important questions: what is the future of our state? What is the future of our children? As I mentioned before, we had 12 task force members, and I want to just mention their names briefly because they did put forth an incredible amount of time and effort. Helen Bassett, Bill Green, Dr. William Green, Myron Orfield, Betty McAllister, Carlos Mariani, myself. House appointees, Mr. Robert Erickson, Catherine Kirsten, my co-chair, Peter Swanson. Senate appointees, including Reverend Robert Battle, Arthur Brown, and Senator Wolf, who's also with us today. As I mentioned, we heard from a wide range of presenters. These presenters came from the Department of Education, which was very gracious for their time and support. They put in an incredible amount of time and energy. We want to thank them especially, as well as experts from the local area, including national experts, who came to Minnesota, testified before our committee, and gave us multiple perspectives to consider. We heard from parents. We heard from students. We heard from educators in the field who are currently implementing the current rule, talking about successes and challenges. When we came to our recommendations, I should note that this was a lengthy process that could have failed from the onset. Because people stayed engaged and didn't come with a solid agenda, we stepped into this as a group looking for learning. We listened to the best practices. We knew that there were changes that needed to be made to the program. We knew that there were components of the program that needed to stay. When we looked at, developed our initial recommendations, I'd like to frame them in a couple of different ways. The first is laying the foundation, setting the structures in place that will help support the programming that will take place in schools and school districts to be successful. We knew we wanted to be sure to increase accountability, increase transparency, and make sure that the public stays engaged in this process. The program that we recommended is named Achievement and Integration for Minnesota, or AIM. And we chose that name because it really does focus on achievement and integration. We didn't believe that it needed to be one or the other, but finding that sweet spot of integration and achievement, because we know that there are components of this that work well. The first recommendation really outlines pieces of the current role that we believe needed to stay. Certainly preventing intentional segregation or segregation at all is absolutely important, and we want to make sure that that component of the rule stays. You'll also notice that we suggested re-examination of the current exemption of area learning centers. The second recommendation really focuses on the Minnesota Department of Education. Our recommendations there require that the department be adequately funded, but also make sure that there is adequate staffing in place to ensure the oversight and accountability that this program desperately needs. We also recommend an evaluation process, so that not only districts know how they're doing, but our communities know how we're doing in reaching and achieving our achievement goals, as well as our integration goals. While looking at numerous forms of measurement, which I'll talk about in a little bit, you'll see that it's not just test scores, it is a more comprehensive view of what does success look like. Recommendation number three outlines where districts must spend their money. They may not supplant, but they should use it on research-based best practices, programs that we know are currently being used in areas of the state that we know work and should be expanded upon. We've broken those down into five key areas: innovative and integrated learning environments, family engagement, professional development, access to opportunity, and increasing the diversity of teachers and administrators. Our fourth recommendation recommends that we re-examine the merits of one collective metropolitan integration district to reduce duplication of services and create efficiencies and greater strategic planning metro-wide. The next portion of our recommendations focuses on the fiscal principles. We did not delve into defining a fiscal formula. We thought that was your job. But we thought we should give some parameters that made sense but also met the goals of our recommendations, as well as address concerns outlined in the state auditor's report. And a couple of those are as follows. Number one, cap the existing revenue program at its current level. Second is leveling the fiscal disparities between demographically similar districts. Second is set aside 0.2% of the revenue to ensure oversight and accountability at the Department of Education. And consistent with that, MDE could withhold revenue for districts not making progress towards goals. I'm not aware of any other program that makes that recommendation. We recommend creating a fiscal model that's predictable over time and stable in two-year increments, as well as defining the percentages of allowable expenditures. This is a change. 80% of the revenue should be spent on students, 20% on professional development, and administrative costs may not exceed 10%. Of course, those are maximum thresholds. Districts may spend more on students. The work that this task force did was pretty incredible. There was compromise all along the way. As co-chair, I certainly didn't get everything I wanted and had to compromise, as I know my co-chair and other members of the committee had to do. This was an incredible task, and I can't thank the legislature and the commissioner enough for appointing extremely capable people to really sit down and look at this critical problem and, with all of its complexities, come to consensus and make a strong recommendation to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And members, we now have a quorum, so we'll officially call this meeting to order. Representative Slocum moves approval of the minutes dated March 27th. Any discussion or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. And members, to the testifiers and the public, my apologies for not being on time. I always pride myself in having the Education Finance Committee began on time, but our good friends in the Ways and Means Committee, after we scheduled this committee, decided to schedule a committee at the exact same time. So, again, no disrespect intended to the testifiers, to the members, or to the public. So, next on the agenda, we'll hear from Mr. Swanson. And welcome to the committee, sir. And please, even though I just said your name, please state your name for the record so 100 years from now we know who you are.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Garofalo, members of the committee, Senator Wolf. My name is Peter Swanson. I was appointed to the Integration Task Force and served as its co-chair. I also voted against the task force recommendations. Does that mean I'm against integration? I mean, that's kind of like being against motherhood and apple pie. But I only speak for myself, but I can provide this hearing insight into how our meetings went and how the votes went. For me, I voted no because there was insufficient detail on how the money can be spent, how it would be enforced, and which districts would receive the integration aid and by what formula. Our task force was praised for bipartisanship, and I believe we could have come up with recommendations that all 12 task force members could vote for, but we ran out of time. On the other hand, it may have been the February deadline that inspired us to work, including a small group of us getting together on Super Bowl Sunday. The task force rules we voted in place required a two-thirds majority, meaning that our recommendation needed 8 votes. Again, I only speak for myself, but knowing the whip count, we couldn't have gotten 10 votes or even 8 votes without the fiscal principles that was the last thing that my colleague outlined in the majority report. And that's what we did on Super Bowl Sunday. In my opinion, outlining how the money is distributed and what percentage can be spent on what items should have been the guts of the proposal. If we'd done that properly, I have a hunch that we would have come back with a unanimous task force report. But I only speak for myself. To explain why I voted no, it's important to outline the two major schools of thought on what integration means. On one hand, you have sustained interracial contact between students. And on the other hand, you have the achievement gap between races. Sustained interracial contact between students is what we typically think of when you talk about integration. It assumes that we're going to move kids around. On the other hand, because this is education, it's unacceptable to have different educational outcomes between races. So that's what where the achievement gap comes in. And we were charged with repurposing the money to close the achievement gap. Now, most people say that both are important values, and there's a temptation to say that they're linked so that if you have one, you automatically get the other. But which is the cause and which is the effect? Some might say that getting the racial achievement gap resolved will result in more sustained interracial contact through upward mobility and greater educational and economic opportunity. The better all races do in school, the more likely you are to interact with people of a different race in college and in the job market. Others say that the opposite cause and effect relationship exists, and still others say they're two very important things, but there's not a cause and effect relationship either direction. These two goals of sustained interracial contact and closing the achievement gap get even more complicated when we see how the money is actually used by the districts that receive it. Again, my objection to the majority report is that there's insufficient detail as to how the money can be spent, how it's enforced, and what formula we use to determine the district's money and how much each gets. It's fun to talk about some of the outrages, like defense spending in the 1980s. We had the $100 hammer and the $400 toilet seat. And here, with integration aid, we have soccer camps and Spanish teachers and hip-hop conferences. But there's a larger problem and mission creep in how the districts are spending money. We heard moving presentations in our task force by researchers, parents, students, and others. One unintended consequence of their presentation is to illustrate how integration funds mean many things to many people. Consider the presenter who spoke of girls in science as a justification for integration revenue. Now, girls in science, while it might be worthwhile, is neither sustained interracial contact or closing the achievement gap. Consider the mother who emotionally spoke of how her son has a learning disability and how the East Metro Integration District helped him. Learning disabilities, while important, are not sustained interracial contact or closing the achievement gap. A young black man who was a recent graduate of the East Metro Integration District spoke of how EMID gave him the opportunity to go to school with people who looked like him for the first time. Now think about that. If the goal is sustained interracial contact, wouldn't you want to go to school with somebody who doesn't look like you, who are racially, going to school with schools with students who are racially similar defeats the purpose. Isn't it the purpose of sustained interracial contact to go to school with others who don't look like you? I should add that we didn't delve as deeply as I would like, but there's a situation of some schools have a school within a school, where districts intentionally create a supportive environment for one race and one school, even though all students are technically allowed to participate, such as the All Nations program for American Indians. Do they sit together in the cafeteria with students of other races? We don't know. Do they have classes other than math and gym with students of other races? We don't know. Certainly this doesn't help sustain interracial contact, either in the school they go to or the school they left. But does it improve the achievement gap? I never got answers to these questions. There was an unfortunate tone to much of the coverage and presentations that the task force was all about closing thus and such integration district or not. Minneapolis hinted that their announced withdrawal from the West Metro District, WEMEP, was contingent on the task force report. But the real possibility exists that they would both withdraw from WEMEP and still keep the money. How do we enforce the use of the funds? When there are so many different things the money can be spent on and the categories are so broad, it's hard to enforce how the money is spent. It's all well and good to say that money must not supplant other things that we're already going to spend money on, but in practice this is hard to enforce. Even a college prep program like AVID, which I support, is something that districts would probably do whether or not they receive integration revenue. The big thing with the current guideline that Minnesota Department of Education has, 60% of the money must be spent on direct student benefit, or the task force recommendation that 80% must be spent on students, is not clear whether intra-district busing is included. In a sense, you could say that busing is spent on students because they're riding in the bus, right? But it's clearly not spent in the classroom and clearly not changing the achievement gap. Does it promote interracial contact? Well, it depends on why they're riding it. Is it to be with their friends who moved away? And when you're talking about a district that is racially isolated, the district is racially isolated, busing students within the district doesn't do anything. That's moving around the deck chairs on the Titanic. Now, for Scott's district, where you have a racially isolated school, you can make the case that intra-district busing actually does promote interracial contact. So, but how do we enforce it? How do we enforce the busing, and how are we enforcing those budgets? In addition to how the money is spent and how to enforce the rules, there's a formula of how much each district gets. I understand that we need to gradually wean some of the districts off of the high amounts that they get in extra money. But it seems that the primary goal is to make sure that Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth get the same amount of money as they always got. And then we figure out a formula that accomplishes this. If one were to think about this in terms of a ninth grade civics or even a Schoolhouse Rock cartoon, we would think that you would decide what the needs are and then allocate the money on which districts had the most need for those things. But that's not what's going on here. If it's for achievement gap, you would look at what the achievement gap in each of those districts are and then allocate the money based on that need. The problem with that, if we did it that way, which we're not doing that way, if we did it that way, is that you would create a reverse incentive, right? Because you would not want to close the achievement gap because you'd get the money. If it is for interracial contact, but you allocate the money based on the number of minorities in a district, then the incentive structure is to not share minorities with the neighboring districts or the not racially isolated districts. One justification for the integration revenue is students must, quote, compete in a global world, unquote. I would think that's true of every student in the state. Is it true for a student from Duluth but not true for a student from War Road? Don't they have to compete in a global world? Is it true that a student from Minneapolis is three times more likely to have to compete in a global world than a student from Worthington, and twice as much as a student from Brooklyn Park? I understand that the current political environment is difficult to deal with these things. In particular, the problem with making the funding fairer between the districts and more aligned to the purposes for which the money is supposed to be spent would be shocking to the districts that are getting the most money right now. But it's hard to gradually wean them from the extra money over a period of 2 years when we budget in two-year increments. Both the legislature and the executive can change parties over time if we're weaning them off a slow time period. And if they're gradually reduced, in a couple of years, they'll come back and say, hey, you cut us 2 years in a row now, or two biennia in a row, so it's time for an increase. Memories are short, and they might get away with it. The other problem with perverse incentives is that if the purpose of the money is to shrink the achievement gap, you get more money the larger your achievement gap is. That's why I think it's important to get the purposes for which the money is spent correct. That can be lasting longer than a two-year budget cycle, and it will change how things are done. So with the current divided government, I would focus on how the percentage of money, how the money must be spent, and making it fair, save making it fair between the districts for another day. As much as it pains me, I think that's the best that we can do at this time. But we have to make sure that 80% is a real number. We should make sure that it cannot be used for busing, that it has to be spent in the classroom. All the flowery stuff has to go into the 20%. That would be a significant reform. That would change the game. But it would not allow the districts who are getting the money to claim that they were cut, because they'd get the same money. And they can't blame their poor performance on being cut because you're giving them the same amount of money. On enforcement, I agree with holding back 0.2% to pay for the Department of Education to enforce. But the rules should be consistent regardless which party controls which branch of government. That's why I think there should be taxpayer standing to file a lawsuit, or even a private attorney general statute where you can earn money by suing. Create a way for individual citizens to get a remedy if the money is not spent as it's supposed to be. The threat of a lawsuit would be a powerful incentive for districts to comply with the rules. Thank you very much.
Thank you. First of all, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Swanson, the committee very much appreciates your testimony. And at the risk of starting a Swanson-Thomas cage fight here in front
we're
of the
good.
Committee. Okay, you're good.
Thunderdome. One man enters, the other. Two men enter.
So at the risk of this, I did want to give you the opportunity to provide just, I don't want to say a rebuttal, but sure. Maybe counterpoints, and then go back to your testimony as well. So
my co-chair does bring up absolutely valid points. And so what I'm about to say is not to diminish that. That said, we looked deeply into what are the current issues. We heard from the legislative auditor. We know what the deficiencies of the current program are. And we believe, 10-2, voted in favor of recommendations that we thought would fill those gaps. We try to be very specific on what districts could and could not use their revenue for. So as Peter talked about mission creep, or gave some examples of some of what I would call benefits, side effects of what is taking place as a result of integration programs. For example, as Mr. Swanson was talking about the Science Museum, and the person that we had, Dr. Liesl Chapman, spoke to us about professional development being offered by the Science Museum, which, by the way, is some of the highest quality professional development around inquiry and STEM available in this country. That is one of their missions as far as engaging girls in science. But as far as it goes to creating magnet schools, school choice, and making sure that parents have viable, strong options, that's come through integration. That's come through the funding that's gone to districts like mine to create innovative magnet schools that provide choice. And unless you provide transportation to achieve that choice, you don't really have true choice. We know that our communities absolutely value having viable options of places to send their kids to school. We recognize that, and speaking personally, we have three nationally recognized award-winning magnet schools. Three principals here today who are nationally recognized for leading those magnet schools. So as we talk about some of the unintended consequences, I like to think of some of those, not all of them, but some of those as unintended benefits. Things that we didn't necessarily know 10 years ago when we started this process, that we would have such that we would be reaping the rewards from.
Thank you. Chairman Groffel, I would say that we didn't go that deeply. I mean, it was like here today, people speaking for 10 minutes, maybe providing a journal article, and we can't claim to be experts based on what we saw, and we quite simply ran out of time. Just as a specific example, the Choice is Yours program, North Minneapolis Southwestern Suburban Schools, is what people typically think of integration funding. And that's sometimes when you explain this to them, that's what they think integration revenue is, busing kids from one district to another. But it's not entirely clear that there's interaction in after-school activities in the cafeteria. And I asked that pretty much every presenter that question, how do you assure that? And national experts and distinguished people, their CV is many, many more pages than mine. Or anybody on the committee, nobody had a real good answer for that, because it's all about the pie charts, and it's all about the theory of it, and we're going to file a lawsuit, and we're going to it's almost symbolic that we've got a good education for them, and nobody interacts with anybody except for math class and gym class, and certainly not in the cafeteria. And the dance line is black, and the cheerleaders are white, and things like this. And I'm exaggerating and painting with a broad brush, but those kinds of things ought to be looked at. And if we're spending the money sort of willy-nilly, those things will never be looked at.
Thank you. A couple of questions for our testifiers. First of all, is that the report that we have passed out to the committee, is this the same one that was posted on the internet in the middle of February?
I don't have an exact copy of what you have, but if it looks like this, okay. It's also posted on the Department of Education's website.
Okay. So,
dated February 15th? Yes.
So I just want to make there's been no changes, additions, or subtractions to the report since it was originally posted on the 15th?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge either.
Okay. And then with regards to the supplement language that was brought up in the report, and I believe we're on three, well, you know where it's at in the report. It makes regards to supplement. What about those situations where a district is a declining enrollment district? What is the task force's recommendations in those situations?
If I understand your question correctly, Chair, it's if a district has declining enrollment, how does that impact their integration revenue?
No, with the recommendations, it says we can't supplant. And this is the committee is sensitive to things called maintenance of effort. And what this is the state comes in and mandates a certain level of funding at the district-wide level. And even if a district doesn't want to spend money on it, it's in statute that they have to spend money on it. And so supplanting is another way of having a maintenance of effort. So the concern is, if you have funding out there that's being used for a certain purpose, and then it's in a declining you're in a declining enrollment situation, so other revenue streams are going down, that impacts all services in a school district, whether it's a large school district or small school district. When you're in declining enrollment, you're in a declining
sure.
revenue state. What is the assessment of that? Would there be different rules for declining enrollment districts?
No.
Did the task force not even discuss that?
Well, I would address that with two components. Number one is that we do recommend the continuance of locally developed integration plans, which means that those are community-developed plans, not an administrative body, but really a community engagement process that says, where should we be spending our integration revenue dollars? That happens every 3 or 4 years, depending on which type of a district you are. So your dollars need to follow your plans, okay? So if the community developed and school board approved plan says we're going to spend our dollars on X, Y, and Z, that's where your budget has to align to, and the Department of Education ensures that by approving or not allowing that expenditure. So there is somewhat of a checks and balances to ensure that you're not just now allocating dollars to cover your losses on ELL FTEs because it's not part of your plan.
So in that,
I hope I answered your question, Mr.
No, it's a, I mean, and obviously, you know, as my colleague Representative Greiling says, you can prove anything with statistics, the Bible, or education finance. So it's a difficult subject matter that we can go into. But what I'm wondering is that if using this supplant language, we would be giving priority to existing ways of doing things as opposed to new ways of doing things. So let me give you an example. We have three mechanisms for delivering service. Two are existing in law. A third is going to be a new service that a school district is going to be providing. In that case, if the school district wanted to fund the new service, they would have to use it from new dollars, whereas the two existing services would have the option of using the existing revenue stream or the new revenue stream. So we're giving a priority to existing service delivery. So that's what supplanting is. So that was my question. Did the task force go into it in that depth, or was it more a preservation of?
No, you know, the department staff did talk about what supplant means, but certainly I think what you're referring to are decisions that are made at the local level. We didn't get into that level of discussion as far as what does supplant mean or what would be the parameters to that. We did not delve into that.
Mr. Swanson, did you want to add anything?
No, I agree.
On page 7, number 3, there are two different terms used. There is a term on 3A, the term school choice is used, and then on point 3A5, the term public school choice is used. And is there a distinction there? Why two separate terms were used?
That was probably unintentional, Chair.
Later on, there's a reference, again, on 3A3 to full-day kindergarten and preschool programming for families who qualify for the free and reduced price lunch. Can you tell me, what was the, in both of our testifiers, what was the thinking with regards to that? Why are we tying it? Why is that program being tied to income?
Well, because this is about access and opportunity. We know that districts are not currently funded for full-day programming, and so many districts charge a fee. This is an opportunity for districts to level that playing field, create access and opportunity for kids and their families who may not otherwise be able to afford it by creating scholarships so that they may be engaged in that program. We also recommend early childhood opportunities so that, again, districts have the opportunity to say, this is how we want to level that playing field early on. Make that early investment. Make sure that those kids who may be low income are thriving with the kids who have the access and opportunity to be in that full-day program.
Chairman Groffalo, I would say that I saw that, and I had a lot of changes were made to this based, even though I've ultimately voted against it, a lot of changes were based on recommendation. I had basically two pages of recommended changes, all of which I didn't get. And you have to kind of pick your dragons, and I saw that in there. I scratched my head, and I moved on to some other things that were more egregious, in my opinion.
Okay. Mr. Thomas, with regards to your answer, you said it was about access and opportunity. Yet we have, in existing law, we have categorical aids that are tied to poverty, that are tied to the free and reduced lunch count. Why not put those dollars into those existing accounts if the focus is going to be on low-income children? Why not use the existing categorical aids or create a new categorical aid that's tied to free and reduced lunch count?
Sure. This is an option, Mr. Chair. Okay. This is not a mandate that says you have to use this. This is under the category of allowable expenditure. So if a local community decided we'd like to put our integration dollars towards a full-day kindergarten program, they may choose to do so.
With regards to the geographic distribution, as everyone knows, one of the big problems of the current system is that of the over 300 school districts in the state, more than 200 do not have access to these funds. Does the task force, for those 200 districts that are currently not receiving funds, is there any recommendations in this task force recommendation to, I believe the term you use is, reduce the disproportionality between tiers starting in fiscal year 14? For those over 200 districts that are not receiving any of those funds, would there be any reduction in the disproportionality for those districts? Either one of you can.
Well, I have not seen a fiscal model. We did not develop a fiscal model. The idea here is this, is that this is categorical aid targeted specifically for integration and achievement. Those two in combination. Racial segregation does not occur everywhere. And so recognizing that there are differences in different communities, whether it be Bowavik or Burnsville, communities have different needs, and if racial isolation is occurring, then there should be some sort of mechanism for that, as well as tying it to student achievement gains. We did not recommend every district receiving the revenue. As you see, that our recommendation was to cap it at its current levels, but within that pool, level some of the disparities. The example that's been given before was Brooklyn Center having a higher percentage of students of color that matches that of Minneapolis or St. Paul, but yet receives substantially fewer dollars. So the idea here is to say, so let's treat apples like apples and oranges like oranges.
And you're correct that there was no fiscal plan attached to this. Was it the intent of the task force to address that issue or not?
Just using fiscal principles. It was not our attempt to draft a fiscal model.
Right.
We just didn't have the resources for that.
Right. But Mr. Thomas, with regards to the reducing the disproportionality between tiers, starting in fiscal year 14, mm-hmm. for the over 200 school districts that currently receive nothing, was it the goal of the task force to reduce the disproportionality involving them, or was it just for the
school districts? No, it was not.
Okay, so it was just for the school districts within there?
Currently, okay. Yes.
And
Chairman Groffel, what I would add is that there were some attempts to actually create a model, and here's how much each district would get. And one of the recommendation that the tier, actually we added a tier, and this was in the discussion phase, was never voted on. This is our Super Bowl Sunday meeting of districts that are over kind of a middle tier between the Minneapolis level and the racially isolated district level of districts that are over 50% minority. and which would include the Brooklyn Center, Columbia Heights type districts. So it's shrinking, adding a tier and sort of shrinking the difference between them. But no, we didn't talk about districts, the have-nots, the districts that don't get any today. The other thing that I would add for the committee's thoughts is if there's a racial gap, no segregation because it's a rural community and you're only one family of whatever race, do you have more support or less support than the student in the metro area who there's a lot of minorities in the community and stores that you can shop at and et cetera? So it may be that the student in the rural area where there hardly aren't any minorities has a tougher time if that's what the purpose for the money is and if that's what the achievement gap says in that district. So there's a problem with the have and have not districts.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one piece. Actually, we did consider that. If you recall, last year, the recommendations that came out of the Minnesota School Integration Council in their report titled Every Child, Every Day actually gave an allowable expenditure or allowed districts to levy for that purpose if they submitted a plan to the Department of Education. So we did actually talk about whether or not that was a viable option. And our committee did decide not to go that route, but we did certainly discuss it.
On page 8 of the report, under 3E, and oh wait, we do have member questions. Okay, I'll ask some more questions later. I'll ask this one, and then we'll go to member questions. When I looked over, I did not see any members waiting. So 3E, and regarding increasing the diversity of teachers and administrators, it looks like there's preferential language there to being admitted to a teacher preparation program. And can either or both of you discuss why alternatively licensed teachers would not be given that, why we would not be using that, or if that was in the committee's discussions? Mr. Thomas?
Sure. I would not describe that as preferential language. Certainly a candidate from an alternative licensure program would certainly be allowed to participate. The goal of this language here is to increase and recruit and attract people from diverse backgrounds to the profession.
Okay, when you read this, it says that, develop and implement recruitment and retention programs that attract candidates in diverse programs who have been admitted to a teacher preparation program.
Right.
So it says they want people who are in a teacher preparation program.
Which could also be an alternative licensure program.
Okay, that was the intent of the task force, though, was to include your...
Yeah, so it's not meant to be exclusive, it was meant to be inclusive.
Good. And then with regards to the, one of the... I'll let members ask other questions. I'll come to that one later. So, Representative, and first of all, I want to thank Senator Wolf, Representative Mariani. I see Mr. Erickson here. Are there any other task force members who are present?
Ms. Bassett, Helen Bassett.
And thank you again to all the task force members. We greatly appreciate your participation. I know right off the bat, people were prognosticating your failure, saying it wasn't a worthwhile exercise, and clearly those detractors were wrong, and we greatly appreciate all the work, including Super Bowl Sunday, for which we all know among men is actually an official national holiday in the United States of America. So,
well, thank you for saying it's worthwhile.
Yeah. If Valentine's Day is a holiday, Super Bowl Sunday is a holiday. So, Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank my two colleagues who co-chaired this task force. You provided, I don't think the public really has a sense of the incredible amount of work and effort and passion and patience just a very
that will actually be effective.
There we go. Very good. Thought the speaker system wasn't on, so.
Oh, my mistake. I turned it off. Sorry.
So this means we had to start all over from the beginning.
All right. I'll need some quarters for the meter.
Any additional comments, Mr. Thomas?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Representative Fabian, Erickson, and Davney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of the questions that I had have already been touched on a little bit. I was wondering about, and thank you, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Swanson, for the work that you and your committee have done. I'm wondering about the effect of open enrollment throughout this process, the way you discussed that. And then also I'm curious to know about some of the internal discussions, maybe a little bit more about, I believe, what Mr. Swanson referred to as kind of a disincentive with regards to the funding because it's based on the number of minorities located in a district, and as you lose those minority students, you would lose funding. And how do we navigate through that?
Mr. Thomas or Mr. Swanson?
Sure. Well, you know, open enrollment is a fact of life, and it's good, and we should encourage it. Because if families see a good option down the street for their child, whatever that option may be, that's great. It's about having great choices. That said, I don't know that I'm not clear as to how open enrollment has actually impacted adversely or positively districts in terms of their integration work.
Mr. Swanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. I can't really speak to open enrollment, just to say that there are some forces who say open enrollment is bad because people will choose to be with their own kind, which is true. I mean, it's just a natural thing to want to be with people who are like yourself, whether it's in the cafeteria or in choosing a school. My concern is that do no harm, just like the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. Don't have policies and school within a school and extracurricular unidos after school activity in the Minneapolis schools that encourage people to self-segregate. So I'm in favor of open enrollment, but let's not do things that encourage self-segregation. And then on your question on the disincentive, we've identified it. Now, what do we do about it? And I don't have an answer for that. And I think it may give people pause to give money to districts based on concentration of minorities. And that's what you're going to get. And so maybe there ought to be a different formula.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'm curious to know if there are other states, other school districts around the country that have been successful in terms of closing the achievement gap and the integration. What types of recommendations do you have in your report that reflects the successes around the country?
Mr. Thomas?
Great question. Thank you. I will speak my own personal experience as a district that had two racially isolated schools, now one racially isolated school, where we have seen our achievement gap close significantly. I'll cite Glacier Hills off the top of my head. Their achievement gap was about 30% and is now 6% based on last year's MCAs. That's significant growth. This is a school that went from the bottom in our district in terms of science scores to number one, one of the highest performing in the state. So it's about effective turnaround. It's about effective professional development. But it's also about the community engagement process that says, I want my child to be part of this school, this learning community that is different, that is expressly for the purposes of integration and achievement. So we know that there are things that work. It's about making sure that we have high-quality teachers in every classroom. It's about professional development that is effective. But it's also about making sure that people have the opportunity to have viable choices. There's a lot of research that supports what happens when we have integrated learning environments. I'll give you another example. We had a non-contiguous attendance area that was largely Hispanic that was going to the racially isolated school. We actually changed that attendance area so that they could attend the closest elementary school. And do you know what happened? Their achievement went up significantly. So when we look at actual data, when we look at real schools and what's really happening, this is working. So, but it takes intention, it takes revenue, but it also takes making sure that we have the right people in the right places giving the right sorts of training and opportunity to families.
Was the school Cedar Park?
Yes, it was. And Greenleaf Elementary.
Right. I went to Cedar Park. Yeah.
Yes, you did. The principal from Cedar Park is here today. And what I'd also mention about Cedar Park is this is an incredible school where they have very much narrowed their student achievement gap. It's phenomenal the work that's taken place at these three schools. And on top of that, they're oversubscribed. We have waiting lists. And by the way, we don't use race as a question on the entry form. It's a pure lottery. So our first priority is let's have good choice. And secondly, let's make sure that when people get to the school, they're learning at high levels.
And, of course, the distinguished alumni of Cedar Park.
Well, and there you said.
No, I'm just kidding. Representative Fabian, did you have a follow-up?
I think there was one more response.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I would say that the task force heard from Christy Hovannis from Florida's Foundation for Excellence in Education. We didn't do a written report because there's no way we would have been able to vote on this person's. We couldn't agree on what they were telling us and who was credible and whatever. Eric Mahmoud from Harvest Prep, which I drove by on my way here. John Alexander from Groves Academy, which is an independent school, private school, but learning disabilities. Well, most of the kids have ADHD. Henry Fonzie Winkler is doing a fundraiser for them. He was in the Star Tribune. Great experience in closing the achievement gap and with learning disabilities. A lot of good methods. I believe that the achievement gap is and integration, you know, racial, different races meeting are both important. I'm not sure that one leads to the other. And I would also say that I'm a little concerned about the achievement gap in the sense that there's no absolute measure. When we talk about rates of imprisonment or test scores or anything like that, it's like it didn't make it in the Meryl Streep movie, but when we talk about the gap, we never talk about what level people are at, because the gap can be smaller if whites are poorer on the test, or more whites are in prison, and you see that with powder cocaine versus crack cocaine. They just raised the penalties for powder cocaine to equalize the thing. So as a former defense lawyer, that's not always a good thing. So just the gap, looking at the gap is not the only thing that we ought to be looking at, but there are ways to do it. It's very important, and if we're spending the money on what I call respectfully the flowery stuff, we're not doing it.
Representative Fabian?
And just one last question, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, on page 7, you pointed this out, the full-day kindergarten, preschool stuff, and the testifiers also touched on this a little bit, too, regarding supplanting and so forth. If there's already schools who are doing all-day kindergarten and they're not able to use these new dollars for that, there's going to be some imbalances there, too, and you touched on that, but I had that in my notes, so I just wanted to point that out. So thank you.
Representative Erickson, and then Devney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, on page 8, under E, increase the diversity of teachers and administrators, would both of you comment on to what extent you can be assured that these individuals then who complete these programs and get the support and financial assistance will be able to teach for at least 2 years in a Minnesota public school? Because we have in present law some policies that probably wouldn't allow that. Sounds to me like maybe you support the repeal of LIPO. So would both of you comment on what assurances you have that that's going to occur?
Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Erickson, I'm not familiar with the exact statute that would require or not require teachers to spend 2 years. That said, I'm actually a product of the Teacher of Color program that Minnesota sponsored about 15 years ago. Well, thank you very much. I'm a product of it. I taught middle school and high school before coming to this position. So I'm a product of that, as are most of my colleagues who went through that program in District 196. It was absolutely successful. And when that funding ended, we saw a dramatic decrease in the number of teachers of color who are working in our schools. So that said, are there existing barriers to prevent newer teachers from staying in the profession? Absolutely. I'm not going to go down the LIFO street here, but you can certainly recognize that there are barriers that may preclude a new teacher from being able to stay in the profession.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, I would say that if a person's concern is diversity, I'm saying air quotes in that.
Let the record show that the testifier used air quotes.
If that is a value and a person is also voting for labor laws that allow, you know, kind of people to say, this is just us, this is just our group here, if we look back in history or we look during the present time, then maybe people ought to look and see if those things are consistent or not consistent, and if we're for the workers, who the workers really are, and what they look like. So I'll leave that to others to kind of reflect themselves and what labor relations and collective bargaining and all those different things actually do if you also believe in what's called diversity.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not quite satisfied with that answer, but thank you, gentlemen. I do appreciate that. I have another question about the involvement of MDE on page 6. Again, would both of you comment on the assurances that the department will have a balance between closing the achievement gap or the metrics that allegedly would be developed locally, that when they look at those metrics, that they're not going to sway one way or the other, that there will be a balance, in other words, between integration and achievement, so that one won't be primary. Because, of course, my concern with your recommendation is that I just don't think it focused enough on closing the achievement gap. You know, so I'm coming to this with a preconceived decision about your report. If it had come to policy, I probably would have sent it back to you and asked you to be more specific. But anyway, would you comment on the department's involvement and what assurances you have from the recommendations you stated that this will be done without an imbalance?
Mr. Thomas or Mr. Swanson?
I can go. Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I share your concern, and that's part of why I voted no.
Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, I have a couple thoughts on this. The first is that it's teachers and people who work in schools who close our achievement gap, and not the Department of Education. So ensuring that we're spending the money in schools is absolutely essential. The department's role is merely to help enforce and draw and support districts in making sure that they're developing metrics that will be meaningful. The example I draw on is QCOMP. QCOMP, the department is not allowing schools or school districts to say we're going to meet that 1%. They've actually developed a rubric that's quite effective and helpful in helping schools determine where they need to be setting their goals. So when we talk about effectiveness, it's actually having real policy that is really going to impact schools and what happens in the classroom. We want to make sure that the achievement side of this is absolutely critical. But we also know, and we vetted this, that integration has merits as well. My co-chair, Mr. Swanson, identified several components of benefits of closing the achievement gap. By closing the achievement gap, we may have greater integration within our society due to greater upward mobility and so forth, things that he mentioned. So it has to be both and. Should it ever be one outweighs the other? I don't believe so. I don't believe that these recommendations say that one should outweigh the other. I think that to ensure that one doesn't outweigh the other, or maybe student achievement should outweigh integration. I don't know, but that is for your committee to decide as you draft that legislation.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both testifiers. I've read the majority report a couple of times. I think I've also read Mr. Swanson's minority report a couple of times. I find it challenging, useful, thought-provoking. I'm not sure we agree on everything, but it's thought-provoking, and I appreciate that. Let me start with Mr. Thomas, kind of where you just left off, I think. Last year, the majority in this body not only voted to create your task force and to impact integration funding, but sent a bill to the governor that actually eliminated integrated school settings as a value in Minnesota, as a goal in both statute and rule. You know, kind of 1952 is how I described it. Did the task force find that integrated school funding was a compelling interest of the state for the students of the state?
Before Mr. Thomas answers that question, Representative Dabney, I believe that you are confusing the original bill as opposed to the bill that was sent to the governor. We did not, in fact, eliminate the integration rule in either of the omnibus bills that was sent to the governor. At least that's my recollection as the author of the bill.
Then let me restate. The majority passed off the floor a bill that eliminated integration.
Actually, no, we didn't.
We
actually put it back in on the House floor.
Okay.
That's
my so only out of here you rejected it. Integration as a value and goal for the state.
So, regardless of
okay. The majority here passed the bill to eliminate integration as a goal for the state. does the task force find that offering integrated education settings is a compelling interest to the state?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devney, without exception.
Thank you.
Representative Devney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to touch a little bit on, again, on the early education and all-day K question that is in the report that a couple of people have touched on. I know in Minneapolis, when children are assessed when they begin kindergarten, 82% of the white children are assessed as ready for kindergarten. 76% of the Somali students are assessed as ready. And then there's a significant drop for other racial and ethnic groups. And it just reinforces what I think we all know, which is the achievement gap starts before kids walk into the school door for the first time. Can you talk about what value, if any, the task force put on early childhood and all-day kindergarten as a way to respond to that reality?
Mr. Thomas or Mr. Swanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney. We didn't get our presenters probably brought it up in writing and maybe orally as well. We didn't get that deeply into it, but certainly we talked about that if you're not reading by third grade, it's going to be a problem. You can see going forward, not necessarily early childhood, but definitely early. Mm-hmm. And that was everybody on the task force believed that. The question really was, so what do we do about it? Do we move, and this is an oversimplification, do we move kids around? Or do we just say, wherever you are, whatever the pie chart, racial pie chart of your school is, let's make sure that everybody is reading by third grade and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm misstating it because I'm not an expert on it, but there was a huge focus on that and a huge agreement. But for our task force and for this body, it's, okay, so now what do we do about it and how do we spend the money? And that's the difficult thing.
Representative Devney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Thomas wanted to add something.
Oh.
Representative Devney, Mr. Thomas.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Devney. We did actually try to address that with that information. That's why we talked about the opportunity for a full-day kindergarten experience versus a half-day. We also talked about parent engagement, making sure that parents understand schools and school systems, how to engage and support the academic learning of their children. We know that many districts have people like family advocates or family liaisons who really support and help families and guide them through that process to ensure that more kids are ready at that kindergarten level. But beyond that, looking at the kids who are currently in our school system, making sure that we're helping to bridge that home-school connection.
Representative Debbie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both gentlemen. We could go further there, but time isn't going to allow us to. The issue has been raised. I've got two more issues I'll try to touch on quickly, and I think you both might want in on some of them. The issue was raised at the Science Museum and of guys, the after-school, what I think of as after-school opportunities. I'm looking at page 8 of the report, the very top. This is 3D Roman V. Where you talk about academic camps, and I'm going to go off of that, and maybe one question when I'm done will be, what do you mean by that? But I look at things like Lego robotics and other things as possibly strategically, if they're strategically deployed, as a positive for engaging learners and providing more equal opportunity to kids to be involved in highly challenging informal learning that provides a new context for their classroom achievement, brings them in contact with adults outside of their life who are doing this work professionally, you know, engineers and things of that sort. Is the academic camps about the value of that? Did you go to that? Because I know if you I had the privilege of coaching my daughter's Lego robotics team last fall. The Minneapolis regional Lego robotics competition, very diverse. At the state competition, hundreds of children, including not only children, but Representative McElfatrick dropped by to visit teams from her district. She's a big fan of it. And both former Representative Coles was there with one of his children, and former Representative Gardner there was was there with one of his children. So it was highly bipartisan as well.
Representative Dabney, given your robotic personality, I'm sure you were natural for that spot.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, your elementary school must have a new principal, otherwise I assumed you would have recognized them when they came in.
Representative
Dabney. Anyway, by the time you get to the state level, it's a pretty white experience. And the only Somali child, girl at least, in the entire Lego Robotics, hundreds of children at the state competition, was the one on my daughter's team. So did you talk, when you talk about academic camps, are you talking about these opportunities to extend learning beyond the school day? What are you talking about there?
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney. That's exactly what we're talking about. As my co-chair raised the concerns of programs or clubs or things that may actually promote greater racial isolation, I think that there was overwhelming consensus that that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is creating academic opportunities like what you just described to bring kids together around an academic focus and take that learning beyond the classroom. That is exactly what we're talking about. Not the, the one race, fill-in-the-blank group that meets after school. We're really talking about academic focus camps.
And my last question, Mr. Chair, thank you. In the minority report, sir, you raised concerns about kind of schools within schools. And your comments today, if I've understood them, have, as was just indicated, focused on having racially isolated groups within schools, formally designated. We're going to have the Latino Students Union or things like that, which I wouldn't want to see us go the way of Arizona, which recently banned any ethnic studies at all. But I'm concerned about what happens often informally, particularly with academic demanding classes, where you can have a racially diverse school and the AP classes are not. South High School in Minneapolis is the only high school in the state that requires all of its juniors to take an advanced placement class. So you walk into AP classes at South High School, and they look like South High School. I know if you walk into AP classes at other schools, they don't look like the school. Did the task force, and this is for either of the gentlemen, talk about measures not just of racial isolation of schools, but of racial, de facto at least, isolation within school programs within a school?
Mr. Swanson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney. Absolutely. I think that maybe my colleagues on the task force were tired of me being a Johnny One Note on this point. And and whether it's a Western suburb, not Hopkins, where I graduated from, and I spent a 30-hour internship for my teaching license there, but some other Western suburban schools, you can lead a horse to water, but look at who sits with whom in the cafeteria. And I coached at Minneapolis South, debate at Minneapolis mm-hmm. South. The team was integrated. The debate team was integrated, but cheerleading and cross-country running, except for Max, who was also on the debate team, was not integrated, and et cetera. And certainly Unidos group at South High was not integrated. Now, this is, and well, one of my former students who was interning at the U.S. Capitol tells me that the cafeteria was not integrated. So it's more than walking into the AP class. Mm-hmm. It's walking into the cafeteria. Now, that happens. People are that way. I'm not going to fix that. Nobody is going to fix that through legislation. But let us do no harm. Let us not put money into things that have people self-segregate. So I'm not saying don't fund International Baccalaureate or AP. I'm saying don't fund all-nation schools, which make the other schools less Indian and Minneapolis South more Indian. So that is, and you call it a supportive environment or et cetera, that's all well and good, but that, I don't know that my tax dollars should be used, and anybody's tax dollars should be used for that. Things that happen naturally, we shouldn't encourage it. So definitely, I'm a board member of the Urban Debate League, and I should also mention there are three fewer robotics teams in Minnesota than there are hockey teams, and next year will probably surpass hockey as an activity. So, but hockey is another one where at least Hmong kids can't play hockey. All those kinds of things. I'm very concerned about that. I just don't believe that government should classify people by race. We shouldn't have quotas and call them something else. and we shouldn't encourage those things. So I share your values. I think you and I just go to a different place in how we get there.
Members or testifiers, again, thank you very much for your testimony. We have to be over the floor at noon. Just a couple of quick comments. Number one is that, you know, I think one of the concerns I think a great many members will have on a bipartisan basis is that under current law, over 200 school districts do not have access to these funds. I think it's very difficult to ask any legislature, regardless of who's in control and who's here next year, it's very difficult to ask members to do that, and I think that's going to be a continual barrier going forward to the task force recommendations, that when you have 212 districts that are not having access to these funds and 125 are granted. That's going to continue to be a concern going forward. But this committee has adopted the approach, and it's one I support, that it's more important to get this right than to hurry up and do it. Certainly, I'm proud of the work the committee has done this year in terms of paying back part of the education shift, of helping our veterans, of reducing some unfunded mandates to school districts. It's unprecedented. We actually passed two omnibus bills out of this committee in an off year, which is something I'm proud of. But realize that this conversation does not end today, that it continues going forward into this session into next year. So, again, thank you very much for your testimony. We greatly appreciate it. And with that, this committee is adjourned. Thank you.